So what's your story?
Okay, so here we are. Here's episode 2 of Art Stories and Outcasts, a true art podcast. What does that mean? Absolutely nothing, really. It's just my own attempt to be cheeky and interesting. It's my own little nod to true crime. So there you go. Who am I? I am Jennifer Bricky, and I am an artist. Like I mentioned in that very first episode, I am interested in stories. I am interested in the backstories. I'm interested in researching and discovering more about why these artists make what they make. So if you are good with bad language, occasional inaccurate recounts of history, and probably attitude, then this is going to be the podcast for you. If not, no worries. You absolutely do not have to listen. The podcast will be released every other Wednesday, so you'll get about 2 or 3 new episodes a month. Just in terms of updates that I wanted to let you guys know about, the website is now live, www.artstoriesandoutcast.com. I've also got a Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The podcast is actually available on most places now, which is super, super cool. So Anchor, Spotify, Google Podcast, Breaker, and recently Apple Podcasts. So, and if you want to email, send me a shout out, or make a correction, you can do so kindly by emailing me at artoutcasts@gmail.com. You know, there's a lot of things that I would like to do better, and there was things that I wish I would have said differently or had more energy or less energy or whatever. But, you know, I'm just going to shut down that obsessive compulsive part of my personality and just be okay with it, because I think it's important just to kind of go out and do something different. And well, there you go. So please feel free to reach out to me if you do notice something and you want to make some sort of correction. And like I said, be nice. This particular episode is going to deal with some pretty heavy subject matter, and as will most of our episodes, but this one in particular, I'm going to talk a little bit about censorship and art. And, you know, if you talk about Caravaggio, who was obviously in the 1700s, then, you know, it was some time ago, but it didn't mean that that kind of artwork didn't ruffle some feathers. There will be artwork everywhere in all time that has ruffled some feathers at some point. Well, especially during modernism and postmodernism. And it's okay if you don't know what those words mean. It's okay if you're not an artist or an art historian. It would be really great if you're not an art historian. That way you don't double check me on some of this stuff. But anyway, it'd be great, you know, wherever you're coming from and whatever you want to know about these things, I'm just here to tell you a story and hopefully leave you with something that you didn't know before. So modernism, basically mid-1800s, maybe a little bit later than that, to 1930s, 1940s or so. And then we have, of course, if you think about the 20th century, think back into all of the different things that have happened in history, all the horrific things, all the great things, all of that is going to influence artwork in some sort of a way. You know, and I think that art and censorship tends to be hand in hand always. You know, artists tend to piss someone off all the time, and not just visual artists, all kinds of artists are going to piss someone off at some point. But if you sort of think back to maybe even some of the musicians throughout time and what they made, and often the ones that were a bit more controversial or a bit braver in a lot of ways tended to make more of a mark in history. Now, I do think that artists have a responsibility, especially postmodernist artists. I think they do have a responsibility to have a powerful voice, and they should, in fact, use it. Sometimes that voice can give us a chance to spread beauty. Sometimes that voice can be used to spread honesty. Or either way, I think it's important that we know to listen. Now, when censorship happens, I think it's kind of heartbreaking. I remember one of my earlier experiences with censorship, and I don't remember a whole lot because it was quite a long time ago. But my friend Sam, I think we were in 10th or 11th grade in our art class in high school, and we had this super rad, super amazing art teacher. Anyway, so we were in 10th or 11th grade, and there was an art contest that we were all entering artwork in. And Sam always did amazingly technical works, just really, really lovely, very, very technical, and often included women in her work. And so in this particular drawing, she had a woman, and it looked like the woman was posing or the woman was dancing. And she named it Dancing with Mr. Bobbitt. And so I remember that, now for those of you, now let me catch up to speed here. So for those of you who don't know who Mr. Bobbitt was, on June 23rd, 1993, and so I'm guessing this was around 95 when this incident, when Sam and I were kind of entering this contest. But for those of you that don't remember, on June 23rd, 1993, Lorena Bobbitt took an 8-inch knife from her apartment kitchen and cut off the penis of her husband. Oh my freaking God. I was doing the research for this podcast and I saw that his name was John Wayne. Are you fucking kidding me with that? And I'm not talking about John Wayne as in John Wayne Cowboy. I'm talking about John Wayne Gacy, dude. Anyway, John Wayne Bobbitt, three names. Those of you in true crime know exactly what I'm talking about there. But anyway, she then drove away from her apartment and threw the severed organ. I'm doing the little quotation marks there. So she threw the severed organ into a field in Manassas, Virginia. Now, of course, this gained international sort of media coverage, as you can imagine. And in 94, during the trial, we actually learned that she was a victim of domestic violence. And throughout her marriage, he had, in fact, raped her, which I believe he actually raped her that night on which she had had enough and just cut off his schlong. So, you know, whether you sort of agree with that or not, I think that that was a really profound moment for women in the 90s, and especially as a young woman in high school. I think it kind of blew our mind as we were finding our own voice. But later, listen to this. So Lorena was found not guilty by reason of temporary insanity brought on by the trauma that she had endured. Fuck yes. She then resumed using her maiden name, became an advocate for victims of domestic violence. Check that shit out. That is pretty amazing. Now, kind of going back, of course, I get off topic really super easy here, but going back to Sam, now, Miss Thomas, our art teacher, really badass, took us into the gallery. We all kind of sat in a circle, and she told us what had happened, that the title of Sam's artwork, Dancing with Mr. Bobbitt, had been changed, in fact, to just Dancing. And I remember being mortified by that. I can't even believe that happened. That seems like the worst thing possible, is to change or alter something that an artist did, or to censor something from an artist. And even like, if you think about context, we can definitely have a conversation about context and where certain artwork goes in the context, but really there is a freedom of expression and we need to pay attention to it. I don't remember what came of it. I remember that when I did go see the exhibition finally, that I remember looking at that title card and thinking about sort of how ridiculous the situation was in terms of the fact that they had changed the name of her work. Would any of the high school students, the parents, actually known who Bobbitt was? Maybe. But come on now. Artwork is a direct reference to what is going on in the world around us. And sure, that's high school artwork, but I think it's still very important that we don't censor those things. Now, I found this great, great bit, and it's on www.arteducators.org, and it directly actually talks about censorship in the arts. And I thought it would definitely tie into what we were doing for this particular episode. So, and I'm going to kind of paraphrase it here, so I'm not reading straight from the website. Private and public leaders seek to remove certain artworks from public display. It is believed, check this out, it is believed that censorship is needed in order to avoid the subversion of politics and the corruption of morals. Okay, whose morals, asshole? Whose morals are they talking about here? Okay, let me read that to you again, because you can tell this gets me a little wound up here. It is believed that censorship is needed in order to avoid the subversion of politics and the corruption of morals. It is not only the artworks that are being subjected to efforts of suppression. These efforts are related to a larger pattern of pressure being brought against education, the press, film, and television. It is important to know that even when such efforts do not actually suppress particular types of expression, they cast a shadow of fear, which leads to voluntary reduction of expression by those who seek to avoid controversy. Whoa. Listen to that, guys. Listen, that is so, so, so huge. Every day that we are living, that is huge. And not just for artwork. It is important to note that even when such efforts do not actually suppress particular types of expression, they cast a shadow of fear, which leads to voluntary reduction of expression by those who seek to avoid controversy. Yep. The arts cannot thrive in such a climate of fear. Word. Our educators as well should be deeply concerned over the efforts at any kind of suppression of works of art. Now, listen to this. And I think this is really important as we're kind of, you know, we talk about free speech a lot, but I don't think we understand to what level it applies to kind of artwork. Now, freedom of expression is guaranteed by the Constitution. This freedom of expression includes both verbal expression, speech, and writing, and nonverbal expression, which includes the language of the various arts. Free communication is essential to the preservation of a free society and a creative culture. Now, as always in our history, artworks, literature, theater, painting, sculpture, music, dance are among our most effective instruments of freedom. This is our way on which we express ourselves. They are powerful means of making available ideas, feelings, social growth, the envisioning of new possibilities, humankind, solutions to problems, and the improvement of human life. Arts improve the human life. They improve it, for better, for worse. They impact who we are. They change who we are. They make us see things in a different light. We need them to survive. Suppression of ideas and of artistic expression leads to conformity. The limiting of diversity of expression to a narrow range of acceptable forms and the stifling of freedom. Okay, so now we're going to move into the NEA. So the NEA is the National Endowment for the Arts. And I have to lay this out because they are a player in this episode. So the NEA, by the way, that website is www.arts.gov. Now, the National Endowment for the Arts is an independent federal agency that funds, promotes, and strengthens the creative capacity of our communities by providing all Americans with diverse opportunities for art participation. Funding. Now, that is where it gets fuzzy. So I did go to a couple different websites, as much as I could stomach, and I did my best to look at both sides of the coin here. But look, in case you didn't know this already, I am probably pro-art before I am pro any political party or many other belief systems. I am pro-art. Always pro-art. Now, on some of these websites, they were difficult to read, and not just because they think differently than I. In what world, Jagoff? Okay. Anyway, let me start. Okay. Some believe that funding stifles creativity. James Glassman from the Washington Post claimed that it stifled creativity, that it allowed for dreary, unimaginative, condescending, and political works. On www.theconversation.com, there is an article written or posted on February 5th, 2017, and it's titled, "Why Do Conservatives Want to Defund the Arts?" it's a really good article. I think it's really interesting, and it helps give a little bit more depth into the conversation of the constant fight of, or I should say, there's many politicians, especially in the last 4 years or so, that have pursued cutting the NEA. So this gives us a little bit better understanding of why that comes up and what's behind it. Historically, the relationship between the state and culture is as fundamental as the idea of the state itself. The West, in particular, has witnessed an evolution from royal and religious patronage of the arts to a diverse range of art funding. That includes sales, private donors, foundations, corporations, endowments, and the government. We got that, right? Because we talked a little bit about patronage, especially royal, private, religious patronage, and how that has changed over the years. Prior to the formation of the NEA in 1965, and I'll tell you who started it here in a minute. So prior to the formation of the NEA in 1965, the federal government strategically funded cultural projects of national interest. Check this out. For example, the Commerce Department, the Commerce Department subsidized the film industry in 1920 and helped Walt Disney skirt bankruptcy during World War II. The same could be said for a broad range of New Deal economic relief programs like the Public Works of Art Project and the Works Progress Administration, which employed artists and cultural workers. The CIA even joined in, funding abstract expressionist artists as a cultural counterweight to Soviet realism during the Cold War. Okay, so in 1963, President John F. Kennedy asserted the political and ideological importance of artists as critical thinkers, as powerful contributors to the strength of a democratic society. His attitude was part of a broader bipartisan movement to form a national entity to promote American arts and culture at home and abroad. Now, by 1965, President Johnson took up Kennedy's legacy, signing the National Arts and Cultural Development Act of 1964, which established the National Council on the Arts and the National Foundation on the Arts and Humanities Act of 1965, which established the NEA. So, since its inception, the NEA has weathered criticism from both the left and the right. The right generally argues state funding for culture shouldn't be the government's business, while some on the left have expressed concerns about how the funding might come with constraints on creative freedoms. So targeting of the NEA has become has more to do with the kind of art the government funded than any sort of impact on the budget. Okay, did you hear what I said? Targeting of the NEA has had more to do with the kind of art the government funded rather than any sort of impact on the budget. Now, I pause because I think, especially with a few of the past presidents, at least since Reagan, there has been many, many conversations about cutting the NEA, and they have been cut quite a bit over the years. But from what I am finding, that the targeting of the NEA had more to do with the kind of artwork that the government was funding rather than the budget. That's crazy, dude. Crazy, crazy, crazy. Instead, the arts were a focus of, wait for it, the culture wars that erupted in the 1980s, which is what we are going to talk about today. There were several artists and artworks in the 1980s that called for elimination of the arts or elimination of funding for the arts because people had a problem with the kind of artwork that was being made. So they just assumed, cut the NEA, get rid of it. I was first exposed to Robert Mapplethorpe when I was teaching art history. He is featured in the art history textbook, the Gardner's Art Through the Ages. And there's this section on him, and I think mostly it doesn't really say a whole lot about his work in general. It more so talks about what happened as a result of the Cultural Wars, or that the threatening of pulling funding from the NEA based on an exhibition called The Perfect Moment. And we'll get to that in just a few minutes. But I was always kind of really interested and fascinated by the story of Robert's work. But it was only through researching for this particular episode that I got to know more about him. And I'm really glad that I did. So I got a lot of information from the Mapplethorpe Foundation, which is mapplethorpe.org, as well as the art story and biography. So Robert was born in 1946, and he was the third of six children. His father, Harry, worked as an electrical engineer, while his mother, Joan, stayed at home raising their six children. And Robert grew up in a very conservative Catholic household. It was nestled in a very quiet Queens suburb. And I read an interview that his father had done shortly after Robert passed away. And the article was heartbreaking, but I think it definitely revealed the divide between Robert and his family, and the fact that they never truly accepted him. I mean, I think there was something that the father said that was in the effect of, I always just wanted him to be normal. I wish he would have been normal. Like, what the fuck is that anyway? According to his father, normal would have been if he would have gotten married and had children and had a job. And if you sort of think about the fact that Robert actually was an enormously successful photographer in New York City in the 1970s and 80s, there was just such a lack of acceptance. And I think that's extraordinarily heartbreaking. So obviously, Mapplethorpe felt that his middle class upbringing was somewhat confining. He was quoted as saying, "I come from suburban America. It was a very, very safe environment, and it was a good place to come from in that it was a good place to leave." He was very fascinated with the Catholic religion and the idea of ritual and mystery. He never considered himself religious. In the 1960s, he attended the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, and he studied painting, drawing, and sculpture. And some of his earlier forms of art were actually collages, where he took bits and pieces of things and kind of combined them together, especially where he would combine magazines, and especially magazines of nudes. And he talked about that in a particular interview, or maybe I read it in an article, where he was talking about being so heavily influenced by the local bookstores and the local magazines, and how he could use those and combine them together for these images. In 1969, him and a good friend, Patty Smith — I always call her Patty Smythe, but I looked everywhere and everyone was calling her Smith, but I always thought it was Patty Smythe. On a side note, by the way, a little bit off topic, yesterday I saw on the news that actually Patty Smith was given a key to New York City, which I thought was pretty nice. And the mayor of New York, the current mayor of New York, also said that calling particular attention to the musicians of the 1970s in New York City and how vital they were. And so I think that was pretty important. So anyway, he moves in to the Chelsea Hotel. And the Chelsea Hotel in 1969, remember, he moves into the Chelsea Hotel. And it's located on West 23rd Street. And the Chelsea Hotel during that time was to artists and musicians as the Cecil Hotel was to serial killers in L.A. I believe Patty actually, I think she detailed a lot of this information about her experience of living in the Chelsea Hotel and her relationship with Robert in her book titled Just Kids. So in 1970, Robert acquired a Polaroid camera, and he began producing his own photographs and converting them in, or cutting them up and putting them into his collages. And he said it was more honest. Later, he was quoted as saying, "I went into photography because it seemed like the perfect vehicle for commenting on the madness of today's existence." Isn't that the truth? But being in New York City had a profound effect on his work. I mean, just think about it for a minute. 1970s in New York City. I can't even imagine. I mean, I was born in 77, so I can't even imagine what New York City would have been like in the 1970s. It was a time of fierce rebellion, unrelenting revolution, and refreshing artistic exploration. If I ever feel like doing Warhol, then I'll talk more about this idea of experimental films in the 1970s and 80s in New York. But Robert actually starred in experimental film, and it was Sandy Daly's film, and it was titled Robert Having His Nipple Pierced, 1970. And what I think is quite remarkable and beautiful is performance artists of the 1970s. I think that there's something so extremely raw and terrifying and gorgeous about them. Anyway, this was a 33-minute documentary film, and it was filmed in Daly's all-white loft, and she filmed Mapplethorpe undergoing the painful procedure by a doctor, the doctor of the hotel, piercing his nipple. I know the movie features the voiceover of Patti Smith, was apparently his girlfriend, Robert's girlfriend at the time. But Robert is also cuddled up with model and illustrator who ended up being his boyfriend by the name of David Crowland. And it's quite a lovely, lovely little film. I've only seen bits and pieces of it, but it seems very, very intimate. Slightly heartbreaking in some way, and I'm not really sure how to describe that. According to Robert, he wasn't taking too many photos at the time, but rather still doing collages. But in 1972, David Crowland introduces him to a wealthy Manhattan art collector by the name of Sam Wagstaff, who later passed away from the AIDS virus. So according to Robert, Sam said, "I'm looking for someone to spoil." Robert grinned. "You found him." The new lovers shared the same birthday, 25 years apart. Robert introduced Sam to the leather at Manhattan sex clubs, and he educated Sam about the 19th and 20th century British, French, and American photographers. And he actually persuaded, because, okay, pause for just a moment. During this time, I'm going to say actually from the middle 50s, 60s, and 70s, and on, you know, New York was the heart of the art world. It was the center of the art world. And a lot of these gallery owners and collectors really helped kind of call attention to specific artists, but really set the trends. And so Robert actually introduced Sam to these different kinds of photographers. But it is believed that he persuaded him to use his authority to convince a lot of other buyers that photography was a legitimate art form, and it was as legitimate as painting and sculpture. So in 1973, in the Light Gallery in New York City, Robert had his first solo exhibition, and it was of a bunch of Polaroids, and it was a wide range of subject matter, from flowers to portraits to erotic images. So this is one of Robert's earlier times of experimenting with some more erotic or racier images. He was always very much fascinated by nudes, and it was more so about finding the sort of perfect form than anything else. It was the lusciousness and quality of the different tones and values that are in the form, and how that form is sort of set against a very simple, plain, dark or light background. Eventually, he actually acquired a medium format camera. And I'm not a photographer, but in my experience in school, I can tell you that The medium format cameras offer a bit better quality. You can definitely have larger prints that are of better quality than having those itty bitty negatives. So I believe that the negatives were in fact larger. So like I said, Robert saw kind of this perfect form. And this isn't the first time we've heard of the word or that kind of phrase, the perfect form, as we kind of think about the Greek. The Greeks often would talk about symmetry and this element of classicism and this perfect athlete, this perfect form. So Robert's compositions were often very, very stark. He would use very, very cold studio lights and precise focus, creating almost this sense of drama and tones and really, really strong contrast. And he loved sort of photographing flowers such as lilies and orchids and tulips and irises and beautiful boys of color. And often these boys that, and I say boys, but these beautiful men of color. And the thing with these men was the contrast of their skin up against the background. There was something so beautiful that it just takes my breath away whenever I see them. It seemed almost like he was playing with a very, very formal, technical, traditional composition, traditional, tight, technical lighting with a tension. And that tension was almost between almost a pornography and art. So there was this gorgeous tension. And he talks about this tension. He talks about the edge of the flower. And he doesn't talk about the softness of a flower. He talks about that edge of the flower and how it reacts kind of almost harshly against that background. So the S&M images would involve models that Mapplethorpe encountered. And one of the most famous New York bars was called the Mine Shaft. They often, the photographs themselves would not depict actual sex scenes, but more like reenactments. And a lot of the photographs that I've seen were often like little snippets of leather. So it might have a photo of a gentleman's crotch where he's completely covered in leather, but that would be, it would be cropped to only that section. And so again, there was this hard versus this soft, this really sort of beautiful dichotomy of something that was a little unknown, a little bit racy, but also quite stunning and gorgeous at the same time. So his photographs were often, if he didn't have those sort of close-ups, he would have reenactments of sex acts. And they were often very theatrically lit against these sort of backdrops. But they were very, very tightly controlled environments. And for him, there was almost like a medieval ritual with S&M. There was like a strict behavioral code, specialized equipment that were used. And it wasn't really all that different for him than fashion and the fashion rituals that woman or the modern woman would put themselves through to make themselves attractive or powerful. He felt that was the same for figures, flowers, arrangements, nude bodies. All of it was shown in a very theatrical way, like this theme of lust and love and longing. And all of them were performers, the flowers, the nudes. These acts were all performers. They were theatrical performers performing under the stage artificial lighting, creating this beautiful image. Whether this beautiful image has any truth to it is kind of up to the viewer to decide. So there were so many different levels of meaning. And he also explored a lot of self-portraits. And he often would play with these different identities and these alter egos, which I think is really, really super fascinating. So check this out. There was an exhibition. There was actually two exhibitions. And in February 1977, so there were two shows that appeared in New York at the same time, and they were very close to one another. And one was at the Commercial Gallery, the Holly Solomon Gallery, and the other one was a nonprofit art space called the Kitchen. So Holly Solomon showed Mapplethorpe's portraits, while the Kitchen showed selections from the S&M work. And it was a separation declaring both mainstream acceptance and underground resistance, making the separation in the shows kind of like this shared announcement. So what Mapplethorpe did, check this out, he actually created a double self-portrait. One hand showed the artist wearing a dress shirt, a Cartier watch, and on the other hand, wearing black leather, gloves, studded metal bracelets, both writing the word pictures, driving home the notion that respectability and perversion are often two sides of the same coin. In addition to this kind of homoerotic subject matter, Mapplethorpe also pushed the limits of gender definition and identity. Stunning in the fact that he was doing this in the 1980s. It blows my mind. In 1986, Robert was diagnosed with AIDS. And, you know, this is the height of the AIDS epidemic and the AIDS crisis. And there was quite a bit of controversy at this time, especially political controversy and the acceptance of AIDS. There was also quite a bit of homophobia, and it was pretty horrific time. But, you know, most people only lived about 2 years after being diagnosed with AIDS during this time. So despite, or perhaps because of being diagnosed with AIDS in 1986, he accelerated his creative efforts, undertaking increasingly ambiguous projects, or I should say ambitious projects. Now, Robert knew fame. He was obsessed with documenting himself. It was actually done about a year before his death. And he's wearing all black, and there's an all black background. And all you see is kind of his head, but he's holding this kind of cane. And on top of this cane is a skull. And it's quite morbid, but also stunning in itself. So Robert Mapplethorpe died on March 9th, 1989, at the tender age of 42. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the time right before his passing, as well as the time after. So now we have what is leading up to kind of what I set you up for with the NEA and with a bit of censorship. There was two main retrospectives that were supposed to open in 1988. Remember that Robert had passed away in 1989. So one of the shows was just supposed to open right before his passing. And the other one, which was at the Whitney Museum, was supposed to open. So the first one was in 1988, just before his passing. That was at the Whitney Museum, and it was comprised of about 110 photographs. And I believe the name of that particular exhibition was just called Robert Mapplethorpe. And it wasn't supposed to travel outside of New York City. Now, the other exhibition was titled Robert Mapplethorpe, The Perfect Moment. And that one was comprised of about 125 photos. And it was scheduled for a tour of 7 U.S. cities, including Philadelphia, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Hartford, Berkeley, Cincinnati, and Boston. Both retrospectives presented selections from what is called the X portfolio. Now, the X portfolio was a group of work that Robert made in the early 1970s, and it was probably his most raw work, and it included the most S&M scenes. And it's just kind of, you know, of course he played a lot with this subject matter throughout his entire career, but this particular collection was a bit more raw than some of the others. And Robert called them his sex pictures, which I thought was kind of charming. The first round of trouble came about in Washington, D.C. And so there's a couple things that happened that were really, really shady. So There is an anti-pornography commission that had been established in 1985, and conservative politicians, notably Jesse Helms and Alfonso Del Amato, A-M-A-T-O, were rallying against various forms of art funding, specifically that of the NEA, the National Endowments of the Arts. They deemed the artwork of Robert Mapplethorpe's to be folding under the pressure of the Cochrane's director, Christina Orr Cahill, C-A-H-I-L-L, canceled the Mapplethorpe exhibition 3 weeks before it was scheduled to open, sparking a cinematic protest rally outside the institution where, check this out, this is amazing, where 10 of Mapplethorpe's photographs were projected on the exterior of the building. So after they canceled the exhibition, there were protests, and they projected 10 of his photographs on the exterior of the museum walls of the building itself. The most striking among these images was a tattered American flag and a self-portrait of the recently deceased artist gazing quizzically out over the crowd. In a bold political move, the Washington Project for the Arts director, I believe it's Jack Reynolds, hung the show across town, attracting nearly 50,000 visitors. Two interim venues later, the perfect moment hit a different political wall. And this was at the Contemporary Arts Center in Cincinnati. Taking notice of the events in Washington, a local organization called the Citizens for Community Values, launched a letter writing campaign to try to block the exhibition from showing. The conflict came to head on the day of the show's opening as lawmakers issued indictments against the CAC, and that's the Contemporary Arts Center, and its director, Dennis Brarie, B-A-R-R-I-E, on charges of pandering obscenity for pictures of homoerotic acts and the illegal use of a minor in nudity-oriented material. Okay, those were the charges for the Cincinnati Contemporary Arts Center. Out of all of these photographs in the exhibition, and how many did I say again? Let me go back up. Okay, so 125 photographs of Robert's work, a retrospective is basically looks over the duration of a career of an artist. A retrospective, 125 photographs. Five photographs ultimately formed the basis of the trial. So, which occurred 4 months later, after the exhibition had completed its full run with record-breaking attendance of more than 80,000 visitors. Two of the pictures of the nude children were eventually thrown out when the mothers had actually signed statements saying that they had authorized those photographs and their use. The CCV, which was, again, the Citizens for Community Values. Now, remember, this is the Contemporary Arts Center and its director that's kind of on trial for the exhibition. And the Citizens for Community Values, the CCV, had generated a mass mailing containing examples of the so-called pornographic works. It included the artist's self-portrait with a bullwhip in his anus, a man urinating in another man's mouth, and several pictures that were not even taken by Mapplethorpe. One journalist said that if the jury were to declare the works obscene, the CCV would have faced similar charges for distributing obscene material through mail. Another mischievous journalist noted that the very same pictures in question were freely available for viewing in town at the public library and in numerous bookstores, and those institutions were not being prosecuted, were they? The jury selected members. The jury was made up of members that had never seen an art exhibition and had never visited an art gallery or a museum. They were asked to decide whether the photographs were obscene or if it was art-based. Based on the consideration of those five pictures alone out of the 120-some photographs of the exhibition. A legal footnote is the judge had thrown out, and I'm getting a lot of this information from The Guardian about this particular incident with the court. So a legal footnote is the judge had thrown out arguments that the contested works must be considered as part of the whole. And the exhibition itself was a total work of art. So there was obvious favoritism towards the prosecution during the entire event. On the Easter Sunday decision, the judge, Carl Rubin, granted the museum immunity from harassment or seizure of works by local police during the run of the exhibition. But in a court transcript ripe for comedy, expert witnesses on both sides testified for and against the artistic merits of the work. Judith Reisman, a media specialist and former songwriter for the children's television program Captain Kangaroo, argued that the photographs were not art because no faces and thus no emotions were visible. In an article published the previous year, she had accused Mapplethorpe of being a Nazi and a child molester. Ugh. Almost as bizarre, Janet Carden, the exhibition's original coordinator, or I should say curator, discussed the artistic properties of the photographs strictly in terms of light, form, composition, evading any mention of their sexual content. Ohio has an obscenity law, and we're almost done here. Hang on with me. So Ohio has an obscenity law, and it states that a work can only be considered obscene if taken as a whole, lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. So after less than 2 hours of deliberation, the jury acquitted Bari, remember the original, the contemporary art director in Cincinnati. So they acquitted him on all accounts, determining that the photographs were indeed art and therefore not obscene. In short, this controversy, as well as some others, intensified the public criticism of the NEA and the funding practices. The following year, the head of the NEA vetoed grants for 4 lesbian, gay, or feminist performance artists, an example of governmental censorship. The artists filed suit, eventually settling the case and winning reinstatement of their grants. Congress responded by dramatically reducing the NEA's budget, and the agency no longer awards grants or fellowships to individual artists. So what have we learned? You know, this is a hard one. It's a hard one to wrap my mind around. It's a hard one to condense, but this is what I've got for you. So at the end of every podcast, once I learn how to talk, I'm going to ask what we have learned. Eliminating the NEA causes the collapse of a vast network of regionally controlled state-level arts agencies and local councils. The NEA is required by law to distribute 40% of its budget to arts agencies in all 50 states and 6 U.S. jurisdictions. Many communities could lose funding to local cultural institutions like, for example, small theaters. So there is some serious misguided logic for the argument for defunding. It targets the NEA, but threatens so many rural and underserved communities. So fuck off. The arts are important. Second, don't be normal, whatever the fuck that is. Be beautiful and be interesting. Embrace worlds and people that are not like you. You just might learn something new. Politicians, lastly, Politicians need to stay out of things that they know nothing about, like art and women's bodies, for example. Okay, that's it. I'm out of here. See you next time.